Okay, this is part two of interview with Jesse Greenstein at his home in Pasadena, California. Part one is at the same place only 4.5 years ago. So, let us start at the review that you did with Grote Reber. It was published in 1947. This is the first review in radio astronomy. And can you try to put yourself at that time and look at the sweep of the field?
What happened was that with the return to university life of the people who had been at the MIT radiation lab, and the first mentioned, without much publication, the first mentions of work during the war on advanced microwave technology, I got again interested in radio astronomy as a potentially new and very hopeful-looking science. And since Reber knew many of the people from his work in whatever it was he did for a company near Chicago, and since we saw each other perhaps every other month or so, just natural course of events from Yerkes to Wheaton, Illinois, it seemed to be a good idea to get together as much information, either unpublished or available by conversation with a few friends. And I didn't know too many people in radar, especially in the MIT radiation lab, except Al Whitford, who had worked there, and a few younger people. But I really knew nothing of that work. So it was an education time, and Reber did much of the first spade work trying to find out who had done what. He was certainly not the kind of person who would write a general review, and so it seemed very easy for us to get together. And I believe that I wrote the editors of the Observatory and said I was going to do this with Reber, and would they refer any new submitted publications to us. And some such things, in fact, did happen. It was before the sort of subdivision of British radio astronomy into warring camps occurred. And so I think we got quite a lot just by correspondence from various people. I remember certainly J.S. Hay's name from that time. I spoke to somebody, a physicist from the University of Chicago, whose name I do not remember, who was at the radiation lab, and he told me first about the Dickey radiometer.
Oh, yes, right.
And oddly enough, in our my earlier interest in how much radiostatic you could explain, the main trouble is you didn't know what the units meant, and you did not have any decent calibration. So I remember talking quite vehemently about the need for accurate calibration of flux densities, as we now call them.
Brightness temperatures.
Brightness temperatures with the new antennae. All the antennae were different.
Right.
And somebody told me, and I wish I could remember, how they had a Dickey radiometer and they had a small portable, perhaps must have been a foot and a half, diameter dish up on the roof of MIT, and they pointed it horizontally and they tried out the temperature of the atmosphere, and they interposed a piece of cardboard to see what difference it
made. Well, this is something that Dickey did with his group just after the war.
Well, somebody told me about it.
Right.
And so I think we mentioned, in fact, in the review, the Dickey radiometer, and that seemed to me one of the important things.
And there is some care in there about, indeed, this business of calibration. You have some correspondence with Towns and that you mentioned about how to interpret Jansky's measurements.
Yeah, well, you see, we had been bitten badly by our lack of knowledge of practical electromagnetic or electrostatic units, But more seriously was that nobody much cared, because if they got a signal, that right. was a miracle. And in particular, therefore, you could not compare energies at different wavelengths. And
right. Would you think it's fair to say that Reber didn't care?
Reber, I think, could not have cared very much, to be honest with you. I believe there was a way of putting some kind of what they call a load, a ballast resistance load or something, but of course it was effectively at or near the focus rather than infinity.
Right.
Unlike the radiometer, where you really compared a final beam with a load that was internal, but in a similarly collimated way, so that there was right. this null effect on switching if you were at the right load temperature. I think he didn't care terribly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was he does have calibration. It's unfair to say he didn't care. But since there was nobody else to compare with, it didn't matter enormously to anybody. For example, I didn't know to your symposium, and I didn't remember certainly, that he had started at much higher frequency and gone back till there was a signal. And I think the idea of just getting enough signal was terribly important.
Right, right.
In any case, we did have, I think, given the times and how early it was, good cooperation from the British and leakage of stuff, some of which was still probably classified from the radiation lab, and names that became famous later,
sure.
I just heard for the first time, since I had nothing to do with it. It's rather odd that afterwards the head of the radiation lab became Caltech's president, and the man who spent a year or so there before he went to Los Alamos became the head of the division, and with whom I worked later, and both were instrumental in working in the Caltech side to get radio astronomy started. They'd both been radiation lab people, but I knew neither of them in 47.
Well, you could just say who they are for the record.
This is DuBridge, who was head of the radiation lab, and Baca, who was there for a while, I think, as associate or deputy director, and then went to Los Alamos.
So in 1947, you were able to write a sort of 12 small page article that pretty much covered all of radio astronomy. And,
that's right, everything we could find, and in fact it's in two pieces, because for some, I think Reber got a job or a different thing, and there was an addendum of stuff that kept coming in later, which I wrote, but we were pretty equally responsible, and I think it's fair to say that it was his knowledge of some people in the field and what had been going on in the classified area that gave me the first look at what had been done during the war, what was done afterwards. We were rather interested in a thing which doesn't appear there, I believe, and may never have appeared. We heard that the Japanese had made experiments using small explosive charges in a laboratory room and detected pulses of electromagnetic energy, which are presumably, now thinking back, actually some kind of convected charge transport in a shock wave. So you have a blast wave, and in the atmosphere it might be hot enough to give you a small ion content, and the electrons and ions separate. And that was one of the things that I found very intriguing, again, looking for a source of the energy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's in.
I don't think so, but you thought that maybe the radio emission might be due to a bunch of little explosions.
Explosive events. Right. And in a sense, it's the idea of a moving, charged plasma, mm-hmm. in modern words. We also heard, and since there Reber was well connected, that a lot of amateurs, which other people have mentioned,
right.
had heard strange radio signals, including some in Japan.
Right.
So right after the war, we got a little, and that's our only insight into the Japanese effort.
What about the solar work at that time? Of course, your work has never been directly solar, but can you remember what you made of the solar bursts and so forth?
Just a book. Well, from the point of view of having come to this with an axe to grind, i.e. if you don't know where the energy comes from, it's not much use, which doesn't agree with how the science developed, which was to detect the waves and later argue about where they came from. The real problem was that the sun was not well behaved most of the time. Reber had had this strange experience, I don't know if it's after the article or before, of getting the sun in a side lobe during a major solar burst when he was pointed to 80 degrees or something from the sun. Mm-hmm. Do you know the story?
No, I don't think I've heard this one, no.
Well, it may have been right after the article, but he was approached very early by the Carnegie Institution of Washington to perhaps come and do radio astronomy under normal research auspices. And as I remember the story, and it's very vague, he in fact had a visit from some people from Carnegie, which I had nothing to do with, and his apparatus misbehaved grossly, and instead of showing the transit of either Cygnus or Sagittarius A,
right,
he got him all kinds of noise and hash on his recorder, and he was terribly embarrassed. And it turned out that later he read that there had been a major solar flare and outburst, and he had in fact got the solar radiation essentially for the first time. The reason for Carnegie Institution of Washington interest in Reber was that at Carnegie, originally both Merrill Tuve and Larry Hafstatt, who would become research director at General Motors later, had done the first ionospheric sounding work.
Right.
And their knowledge of that kind of swept frequency device, and actually I think a detection of a ship on the Potomac by accident, was one of the things that helped, right, American radar along. Well, I think out of Merrill Tuve's very broad interest in absolutely everything, he being, I think, then head of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism,
right,
at Carnegie, there was this approach to Reber. And I think somehow this got in the way of the end of that article. And so we never went beyond that. In any case, I left only a year or so after it actually appeared.
Let's talk about this AAS symposium. Can you tell me what you remember of that?
I remember nothing. I'm glad that you brought it to my attention. The only hypothesis I can make is that in connection with a AAS meeting...
In late 48?
Yes. This is a release dated December 30th, 1948, and it was at Yale. There was a mini-symposium in which the speakers were myself, Ralph Williamson, who was then at the David Dunlap Observatory, but who had been a student at Yerkes, a graduate student, John Hagen, then Mr. John Hagen, I see, of the Naval Research Lab. And clearly, John Hagen would have been talking, though I don't have the data about that, on solar radio emission,
right,
which much later became his thesis, when you could see between solar bursts to see what the quiet sun was and work at the suitable frequencies to see the lower corona and chromosphere.
Right.
So it looks to me from that list of speakers that it was the first getting together of the few people, except the radar experts, who were going to be interested in radio astronomy.
In an astronomical context.
Yeah, in a purely astronomical context. Ralph Williamson was in fact a purely theoretical astrophysicist who had worked with Chandrasekhar. He was a very quiet and gentle personality, and given to good mathematical theoretical work applying atomic physics concepts, and I think, I forget what his thesis was about, but perhaps it was stellar interiors with Chandrasekhar. And
this is rather different, though.
Yeah, but now again, you must remember that atomic physics and theory of opacity of matter and stellar interiors have a relation to the then prevalent ideas, and are still valid and important ideas, of the absorption of radiation and its re-emission at any frequency. And one of the things that Williamson did, in fact, now I believe I'm correct, was a study of the opacity of the negative hydrogen ion, which was important for stellar atmospheres, doing a purely quantum mechanical computation. And again, because we were trying to fit things into the framework of thermal radiation from hot objects, it was relevant. And Hagen certainly knew of radio bursts, but unfortunately was trying to explain solar radiation by thermal mechanisms.
Right.
But all in all, these were important people, and John stayed on for a long time.
Well, Williamson collaborated with Seeger on the galactic background and mapping it and so forth, sort of galactic structure.
That was at Cornell, but that was appreciably later, wasn't it?
Well, 2 years. One or two years.
1 or 2 years later. Apparently, he had gotten a job back in Canada after the war, because I remember him as a student at Yerkes during the war. In particular, he acted in some of my wife's community theater things, which we ran during the war with no male help to speak of since everybody was drafted.
I see.
Williamson was a very a serious scientist, as I remember it also. For many years, he worked at Los Alamos on opacity problems, which is important in radiation trapping and the fireball.
And one final thing that you mentioned was that in fact, we found that you were a counselor of the AAS at this time, and probably, therefore, were the,
that's right.
the one that organized this session, although you can't remember.
I don't remember it, and it seems natural. Actually, one of the reasons, I'm almost certain, the meeting was at Yale, was Lyman Spitzer. And again, though Lyman's work had been in anti-submarine warfare, his knowledge of that part of theoretical physics relevant was the earliest knowledge that came into astrophysics of plasma physics as such. And at this same meeting, I'm pretty sure Lyman, having had a half of a drink because it didn't take much, did the dance of a high energy electron, dance of an excited electron in an intense magnetic field, which was essentially how you get trapped on a field, and has, in a sense, some ultimate reference to the future plasma fusion research which he and Schwarzschild started. I'm almost certain it was because Spitzer had gone to Princeton that the meeting was there, because the meeting a year or two organized after the war, you know, these things had to be organized within a year after people had left the war work.
Right.
It depended on individuals very much.
You mean Spitzer was at Yale at this time?
At Yale. Spitzer was a junior professor at Yale. Okay, so
you went to Yerkes, and then how long were you there? How long was it? Or I guess what I should say is, when did you leave Yerkes?
Oh, I left Yerkes in mid-June 1948. So I was already out of Yerkes and at Caltech and Palomar Mount Wilson.
And the next reference I then have to a publication of yours involving radio astronomy, although you may have been thinking about these things, was in 1953, with Rudolf Minkowski on the Crab Nebula.
Oh, that okay. Did you have the references, or I had them somewhere earlier, of the work with the Yerkes group?
Oh yes, we talked about that last time.
We
talked about that.
Because I noticed somewhere or other we mentioned bound transitions, which I thought, looking backward, was rather perceptive. Only we didn't follow it up. Anyway, I went to Caltech. Radio astronomy had to stand aside for a while because I was in a place where I had enough to do. And that was to start the department and to get a staff for the newly completed Palomar Observatory.
Was there no Department of Astronomy before?
There was no Department of Astronomy. There had been a PhD in astronomy, in an astronomical subject, done by a student in the physics department, Olin Wilson, who retired only recently from Wilson and Palomar staff. And he was the first PhD in radio astronomy, in astronomy, but he was a physics student.
Right.
There was one legal astronomer in the department, that was Fritz Zwicky, who had been a physicist and become interested in astronomy. There was a teacher of elementary astronomy course on the solar system, essentially, and that's all. And I came to a large, empty building filled with the residue of research from World War II, from John Strong. John Strong's first vacuum pumps were still in the basement, all crystallized and had to be disposed of, and samples of almost every element in the periodic table that Strong had tried in his early experiments on aluminizing mirrors when he was a professor at Caltech.
But you relative to radio astronomy, though, it seems like it was with the influence of Minkowski and Botta that you became interested, or
yes.
Mutually...
Yes, I certainly turned back to it. I retained an interest, and much more sharply than it would appear, because of a different thing, and that was the work on interstellar polarization and the almost certain requirement for an interstellar magnetic field, which dates from the work by Leverett Davis and myself.
Right, this was going on about the same early 50s, right?
I think it started in 49.
Right. And were you thinking all the time that this had something perhaps to do with the origin of these radio waves, or was that only a later connection?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, that was, to my mind, almost obvious. Once one realized, and I had from listening essentially to Enrico Fermi, Fermi and Chandrasekhar tried to accelerate cosmic rays in space. Fermi liked an acceleration process involving interstellar magnetic fields, and he liked also a magnetic field to keep the cosmic rays trapped in the galaxy so that the total energy in the universe wouldn't be overpoweringly large in cosmic radiation. And so for both those things, he had at a different meeting, and I have no idea when that was, a very good lecture, essentially suggested that the magnetic field energies were of the order of magnitude of the cosmic ray energy density in space, and that if there were fields in clouds, as clouds moved to each other, an electron trapped on a line of force connecting clouds would be accelerated and attempt to get into actually equilibrium in total energy with a moving cloud. Well, since a moving cloud may have 100 solar masses and a lot of magnetic field, the electron can get to very high energy, but of course it then leaks off out of the acceleration mechanism long before. The other thing, I believe, and I can't date it, was that a man named Peters, a physicist, at Chicago, had been looking for the electron and positron component of the cosmic radiation at about this time, and began to establish reasonable probabilities that there were electrons, so that Fermi's requirement of the field, the fact that there were cosmic ray electrons, at least possibly, though it was still, I think, not certain in the 49 period, made it pretty obvious that the observations of first, I guess, Al Hiltner and then of John Hall in much greater detail, which produced evidence for an interstellar polarization rather than a stellar polarization, that this required a link, and it was an obvious link. That's how Lever Davis and I, and how Spitzer came automatically to the idea that cosmic rays indicating existing magnetic fields had to be connected with the origin of the interstellar polarization.
But now the link to the radio radiation, however, was not really made in the West at this era.
No, it was not made. It was made in Germany, oddly enough, and sort of forgotten in the solar context of radiation of gyrating electrons above magnetic fields and sunspots. That's what's it keeping it there.
Well, there were two very short little articles in Phys Rev in 1950, one by Kiepenheuer and one by Alfain and Herlovson. But they just died. I mean, no one did anything with them in the West. And what I'm referring to, of course, is that Shklovsky and Ginsberg and their associates just ran with the ball in the early 50s. Do you have any thoughts on why this was not thought viable or a fruitful field in by someone like Fermi or Chandrasekhar or Spitzer or you?